Intuition, precognition, telepathy. Rupert Sheldrake says they are not paranormal, but in fact, quite normal functions. We'll be back with him in a moment. Also, on his website, which is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com, he is inviting you to participate in his ongoing research, online experiments. Go take a look. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, Rupert Sheldrake, our special guest for the next 2 hours. He studied natural sciences at Cambridge and philosophy at Harvard. He received a PhD in biochemistry at Cambridge. He was a fellow of the Clare College in Cambridge and a research fellow of the Royal Society. He's the author of more than 60 scientific papers and several books, co-authored a book with the late Terence McKenna, as a matter of fact, called The Evolutionary Mind. He makes a compelling case that intuition, precognition, telepathy are not paranormal, but are in fact normal functions drawn from our biological past. His website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's been on before, Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert. How are you?
Hi. I'm fine, thanks.
It's always a pleasure. Boy, tell me about these online experiments. Fascinating.
Well, I've done lots of experiments on telephone telepathy, email telepathy, and so forth, which work very well, and they're sort of manually operated. I've now got these automated tests that anyone can do through the internet. The internet turns out to be a perfect way of doing this sort of research, because for a test of telepathy, you need to have a person and someone who's sending them a message or a thought or an intention. They need to be separate from each other. They need to be linked up. They need to know when the test is happening. And the internet can do all these things with people over any distance. So it turns out to be a very good medium for this. And I've now got an automated email telepathy test, which once you've logged on, it's just a matter of you get some emails from your senders. You have to guess who's emailing you, but just before you get the email. That's all done automatically. The scores are automatically kept in a file, and you get your results at the end of the test. And, of course, it's free.
And you're doing, what, 5 tests here, I see?
I've got, yes, several different tests. I have a text message telepathy test that works with text messages on cell phones. That one only works in Britain, unfortunately, at the moment. So people in the U.S. can't do that one. But the email telepathy test works fine in the U.S. It's been tested out. It's quite a new one.
Tell me, what are we looking for with this?
Well, there's 2 or 3 points here. First, there's the ongoing debate with the skeptics, you know, who say telepathy doesn't exist.
Right.
So the idea is to enable anyone to take part in tests of this to provide, hopefully, a lot of evidence that it does. I think there's already a great deal of evidence that it does exist, but this is a way in which the evidence can go on piling up. And it's a way of getting the research out of universities and research institutes into real life, so anyone can take part. And these experiments can be done in schools and colleges and at home by anyone who's interested. So that's the first point. It's a way of doing research. Secondly, it's a way that anyone who's interested can find out how telepathic they are and how telepathic they are with different people, because no, our telepathic abilities aren't indiscriminate. They work best with people that we're bonded to, and they work better with some people than others. And this is a way of finding more out about yourself and how your bonds with others work. And third, the way in which the experiments work gives us information about the process of telepathy, what sort of things affect it. So it's really part of an ongoing research into the nature of telepathy, in the way it works in the modern world through emails.
Tell me about this online staring test. I find this one to be fascinating.
Yes, that one, this is the feeling of being stared at that most people have had.
Right.
A lot of people find they can feel when someone's staring at them, they turn around and there's someone looking at them, or you can stare at somebody else and you can sometimes they get restless and turn around and look at you. So this is, a phenomenon that's very common. Most people have experienced it. But it's one of those things that dogmatic skeptics say can't possibly exist. It's all rubbish and so forth. There's already a huge amount of evidence that it does exist. And here again is a test that anyone can do at home. The staring in this case isn't, the staring itself isn't online in the sense we're not looking at people's images through webcams. You do it at home or at school with another person. And the instructions on screen tell you whether to look or not at the other person. They sit there, preferably with a blindfold on, with their back to you. When the trial begins, the computer emits a beep, so everyone knows the trial's begun, and then within 5 or 10 seconds, the subject, the person with the blindfold, guesses if they're being looked at or not. And there's a random series of trials. Either you're looked at or you're not looked at.
Right.
And each trial you have to guess if you're looked at or not. You're either right or wrong. And people are definitely more right than wrong. They're never right all the time, but the results show statistically there is a real effect.
How do they know this? How can they feel this?
Well, what it feels like when you're doing the test is it just feels like guessing. For most people who have never trained themselves to this level of sensitivity, you know, under conscious control, it's a kind of unconscious thing. And so how you experience it is you just guess, and what happens is you guess more right than wrong in most cases. So most of us have never really tried to develop these sensitivities. I mean, there are people who do try to develop them, and those are people in the martial arts. You can actually be trained in some martial arts courses to develop your sensitivity. And the other people who get very sensitive through, I dare say, through experience and through necessity are criminals. The police, I've spoken to a lot of police and private detectives who say that when they're doing surveillance operations, some people who become very surveillance conscious, so particularly criminals about to commit crimes, because they become very wary, very vigilant about whether they're being watched.
Mm-hmm.
And people who it matters to, you know, people who don't want to get caught, also people under threat in dangerous situations, this ability becomes much more sensitive. In sort of experimental conditions where you know you're perfectly safe and secure and nothing bad's going to happen, it's not actually a very good way of testing it, but it's not really feasible to test people under situations of genuine danger.
Rupert, telepathy, paranormal, supernatural, very normal, what is it?
Well, I think it's normal. I think it's a... I've done a lot of work on telepathy in dogs, cats, and other animals. I think telepathy is a normal way in which animals in social groups stay in touch with each other at a distance, because most animals in groups have to split up some of the time. For example, in wolves, the adult wolves go out hunting, often ranging over hundreds of miles. The baby wolves, the cubs, stay behind in the den, usually with a babysitter. And so they're separated by a long distance. There's no way, they haven't got cell phones. There's no way they can keep in touch by any kind of technology. The only way that the members of animal groups can know what the others are doing at a distance, or know if they're needed or if there's danger, is through telepathy. And I think it's developed as a perfectly normal means of communication within animal groups. And it's mostly to do with feelings of danger, knowing when someone's approaching, reading intentions. It's not really about communication of complex information. It's more about needs, wants, emergencies, and so forth. And until the invention of modern technologies, that's the only way people could keep in touch at a distance, too. A typical situation would be a mother suddenly feeling her child's had an accident or needs her, rushing home and finding that actually just that kind of thing has happened. So there's many examples even in the modern world of
this.
Absolutely. I think it's rooted in our biological past, in our human pre-technological past. We don't need it so much today because we've got technologies. But I think animals have used it for millions of years. So I think this is a very deep-seated biological ability.
I mean, I can't tell you how many people have called this program, Rupert, to talk about cases like that, where they had these feelings, these gut feelings, this intuition, this form of telepathy. They just knew something was happening. They knew that someone had died. They knew that there someone was in an accident and needed help. It is amazing how this extra sense, is that accurate? Can we say that? It's another sense of your body, of your physical being?
Yes, I think it is another kind of sense. Yes.
There are skeptics out there, though. You know, Amazing Randy doesn't believe in this, claims that he's got $1 million for anybody who can prove him wrong. I've had on this program Michael Shermer, who, of course, heads up the Skeptics magazine. You know him as well?
Well, I've never met him. I've actually written for his magazine, and we've been in email contact. I've never met him personally.
Skeptical Inquirer, I believe, right?
No, his magazine's called The Skeptic.
The Skeptic,
and there's an advocacy group called PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. They publish The Skeptical Inquirer. So there's several rival skeptical outfits there. In fact, you know, there's a whole skeptical industry.
Which is healthy.
Oh, yeah. I think it's healthy, but I don't think their skepticism's necessarily healthy. I think healthy skepticism is open-minded, you know. You want to know the facts, you want to see the evidence, fair enough. That's why I spend most of my time doing experiments, you know, trying to provide facts and evidence and find out more. I think that's perfectly healthy. What isn't healthy is dogmatic skepticism, people who've got a belief system, a kind of scientific fundamentalists, who think they know the truth already. They don't need the facts.
And, would they take your data and let's say it proved beyond a question of a doubt?
Well, they don't. What they do, I mean, take Michael Shermer. Here's an interesting case. When my book, The Sense of Being Stared At, and Other Aspects of the Extended Mind, came out in the U.S., there was a feature about the book in USA Today newspaper. In the journalists writing the thing, they, you know, in journalists, they always have to get a skeptic. That's the reason these skeptic groups flourish, because there's a media convention, you've got to have a skeptic. And they form these organizations, say, okay, we're the skeptics, call us. So they're on every journalist's sort of telephone Rolodex. They ring them up. So Shermer's one of the people they always ring up. They rang up Shermer, said to him, you know, what do you make of Sheldrake's evidence and stuff. So he said, and was quoted in the paper as saying, everything Sheldrake claims can be explained by perfectly normal means. It's all rubbish. So when I saw this, I thought, okay, well, let's hear how he does explain it. So I emailed him and said, I've read your quote. You know, what is the perfectly normal explanation for all these things? And he replied saying, oh, I can't tell you in detail. I haven't read your book, haven't seen your book. And so then I said, okay, well, why not read it, and we'll have a public debate.
Sure.
I challenged him to a public debate on the Internet.
Bring him on the show.
Well, that would be another possibility.
Yep.
I challenged him to this public debate. He accepted the challenge, but months later, he said, oh, I haven't got around to reading the book. I'm much too busy. So basically his line is, you know, it's all rubbish. I've got another explanation, but when it comes to the evidence, he hasn't got time to read it and can't be bothered. So he's never actually agreed to this challenge. I mean, he agreed to the challenge, but he's avoided it. Doing it on your show might indeed be a perfect way of doing it.
Yeah, we'll see if we can arrange something like that. He's been on the program before. He's debated a little bit before, so he's not opposed to that.
No, no. And he's an articulate and he's a smart guy. So I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I have had debates with skeptics here in Britain. Two of them, in fact, are available in streaming audio on my website. One's a famous British skeptic called Lewis Wolpert, who's a leading scientific figure. He's always saying the paranormal is bunk and it's all rubbish and so forth. I challenged him to a debate at the Royal Society of Arts in London. We had a judge in the chair. It's a very distinguished audience. This is a, you know, sort of highly respectable establishment organization. We had half an hour each to present our case. He went first, and after 10 minutes he sat down because he said, you know, it's rubbish, it's pathological science, anyone who believes it is stupid or has got something wrong with them, you know, these people are all frauds and charlatans and so forth. But after he'd said that several times, he couldn't go on saying it. He sat down. Then I stood up and talked about the evidence, went through lots of evidence, my own experiments, Dean Radin's experiments, mm-hmm. you know, the reviews of the literature, stuff from journals, tons of evidence. And it turned out he hadn't read any of it. And when I showed the evidence, I had PowerPoint presentation, I showed a video of an experiment and so forth. He sat on the stage in front of the screen. He didn't even turn around to look at it. He stared out, looking bored, tapping a pencil on the desk.
Oh, my God.
The entire audience could see he was doing that. And then it turned out he was so convinced it's rubbish, treated all the evidence with such contempt that he didn't think it was even necessary to turn around to look at it. And he lost the entire audience. His performance in that debate was disastrous because he revealed his ignorance and prejudice. And yet the media treat him as an authority. Now, there are some well-informed skeptics. One of them in Britain here is called Professor Chris French. I had a debate with him at Trinity College, Cambridge, a few months ago. That, again, is on my website in streaming audio. He is informed. He does read the evidence. And he says, yes, there's a lot of interesting evidence. These things do seem to show significant effects. I can't think of other explanations for them right now, except some people might have been cheating, but I agree there's no evidence they were, and so on. He says, I'm a skeptic, I just don't think there's enough evidence, we need more research. Well, that's a much more reasonable position. So there are reasonable skeptics like that. But interestingly, he doesn't get angry and upset and emotional like the dogmatic skeptics.
Sure. Do you think if some of these skeptics had one true experience of things that we've been talking about, something telepathic, something that maybe showed them some proof of the afterlife, they would change their minds, or do you think they would be in denial?
I think it's hard to tell. It would depend on the person. There's examples of both. Most people who believe in these things don't believe in them because they've spent hours studying detailed statistical evidence. They believe in them because they've had the experiences themselves. And that's true of a lot of scientists. It's not true to think that all scientists are skeptics. They're not. When I give talks in scientific institutes, I find most people are actually open-minded, and most of them have had these experiences. I mean, telephone telepathy, thinking of someone who then rings on the phone, about 80% of the population have had that experience. So we're not talking about things that are very, very rare or obscure. Most scientists are normal people, and they've experienced them too, and most of them are interested because of that. But when you have a dogmatic skeptic, someone who's got a worldview that says these things are impossible, if they have these experiences, say with a phone call, they think of someone who then rings, or they have some striking thing, they think about somebody, they later find out that person's had an accident. So there's a striking types of telepathy like that. Yes, they go into denial, some of them. They say, oh, well, it was just a coincidence, you know, and if you think there's anything more, it's just reading something into a coincidence. The human brain has the capacity to attribute purpose to things where none really exists, and so forth. Then they go into a long thing about how our brains can deceive us, and so forth. So, yes, for the true believer in skepticism, you know, that's it's denial is the course of action they take.
Well, when we come back after this break, Rupert, let's talk a little bit more about these experiments and what you expect to prove with them and how long you've been doing them. And then next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. You might have a question for Rupert Sheldrake, or perhaps you have your own experience that you want to share with us, your telepathic experience, what happened in your life. I bet we'll get a lot of people calling with things like that. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but if you're just driving around and you want to remember it, it is S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E. So it's sheldrake.org. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Those of you fast blasting and emailing me, just telling me about the Peter Pan peanut butter, and thanking us for having this story on, let me just simply say it is our pleasure, our responsibility to do that for you. So I'm so glad that A lot of you have those numbers that you found because you listened to the program. We'll be back in a moment with our guest Rupert Sheldrake. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Rupert, what was it like working with Terrence McKenna, who died short of his 54th birthday on April 3rd of 2000?
Well, I wouldn't call it working. I would call it having fun together, actually. He and I became friends on my very first visit to California, which was in 1982. And thereafter, whenever I was in America or whenever he was in Europe, we used to meet up and just hang out together, usually with Ralph Abraham as well. And we just had such a good time talking. Every time I saw him, Terrence would have some new idea, I mean, or something he was interested in. Once, for example, I remember he said, "I'm interested in the brains of cephalopods," and started talking about octopus intelligence. And, you know, I'd never thought much about octopus intelligence. And then how they communicated by changing their skin color. And he said, you know, he'd go on for 15 minutes about how you got this direct readout by looking at them and how they were showing each other this sort of skin display of their state of mind, etc. I mean, it was fascinating stuff. And his curiosity about science and little-known facts of natural history, cosmology, etc., was quite staggering. So we had just a lot of fun. And there were, you know, he, of course, was a highly intelligent and well-informed and educated person, but with this astonishing bardic gift. I mean, he had his ancestry was a combination of Welsh and Irish, and this gift of language, sort of poetic speaking. It was just and funny. It was just such fun being with him and Ralph. And after we'd been meeting together and just hanging out for about 7 or 8 years, Nancy Lunny at the Esalen Institute knew us all, and she got to know about this and said, "Why don't you guys do a public program of trialogues?" Which we did, and that led to our first book, Chaos, Creativity, and Cosmic Consciousness. And we did another one, The Evolutionary Mind, which really based on tape recordings, edited tape recordings of our conversations. But it was just tremendous fun having these conversations, and they could go where no other conversation could reach.
He was way ahead of his time. Sadly, died of brain cancer, didn't he?
Tragically, yes. He had this, we don't know why. I mean, he didn't know why, but he had this brain cancer, and the doctor, when he first diagnosed it, said, "You've got a year and a half to live," and he lived a year and a half after that.
It was a shame, because he was, you know, whether one wants to argue the merits of some of his use of psychedelics at the time, he was brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant, yes. Completely brilliant and imaginative and... he combined a kind of rational intellect and with the kind of wild imagination and brilliant creativity. It was an extraordinary mixture, really.
A lot of scientists tapped into him for information.
Well, he was very well informed, and he had a whole network of people who kept him informed. He was a very remarkable person, a great loss, a tremendous loss.
Let's talk a little bit about the experiments now. What are you wishing to obtain? What's your hope here with these experiments?
Well, what I'm trying to do, the online experiments, the ones that anyone can do by going to my website, what I'm trying to do is develop experiments that are easy, simple, and fun to do, that anyone can do online, that provide, hopefully, strong evidence for the reality of telepathy and other forms of ESP. And I think you see that once there can be simple, repeatable experiments, that's what you need for sort of standard science. If you study physics and chemistry at school, at least here in England, you do practical classes as well, and you do sort of standard experiments. And part of learning science is doing standard experiments that illustrate what that science is like. Now, if parapsychology becomes part of normal science, I think it should be part of normal psychology. Para means beyond, so I don't actually like the word parapsychology. It implies it's somehow beyond psychology. I think it's just part of psychology. It's a regular part of our minds. If that becomes part of school and university courses, then students need to do experiments for themselves to, you know, find out what it's like for themselves through their own experience. And the online staring test is already used in some schools and colleges for that purpose. And the online email telepathy test, I think, could serve that purpose too. It's only been going a few weeks, so it's too early to say. So that's one point. Then another point is that these tests are fun to do, and they tell you something about yourself. And I've had quite a lot of interest from big computer firms in these tests. First was Microsoft. I gave a seminar at their Redmond Research Center a couple of years ago. In fact, that's available in streaming video on my website, my Microsoft seminar. Some people at Microsoft were very intrigued by this and thought that they could run these telepathy tests on the Microsoft platform. And then millions of people could do them instead of a few hundred that had done them on my website. And some people, that's the reason they invited me. Some people at Microsoft were very, very excited by this idea. And at the seminar I gave, which was packed with, you know, very, very well attended seminar, there were a few standard skeptics there, of course, who said it was all rubbish and stuff. There were a lot of people who were very enthusiastic. I dealt with all the questions from the skeptics and so on. And how it ended was that there were several people there who were very, very keen for Microsoft to work with me, developing even more user-friendly, easy-to-do versions of these tests. But there were other people in Microsoft who weren't against telepathy. They just said, well, this would have implications for our corporate image, you know, because telepathy could be considered kind of flaky, and that might, you know. Now, I said, I think it'd be awfully good for your corporate image, which is really boring and not terribly
well said, Rupert.
And, but they said that, you know, that they had to leave it to higher authorities and so on. And so the higher committees or whatever they have at Microsoft considered the issue and decided it was indeed a bit too risky for their corporate image. So they backed off. Well, the next approach I got was from Google, from their London office. And they were interested in doing these tests on their platform. And there the issue wasn't an ideological one. Like with Microsoft, they were afraid about the corporate image, as some people there were. The Google people weren't. They were just trying to think how, if they do these tests, they can combine it with their advertising strategy,
right.
You know, how it would work commercially. They're still thinking about that. Then the most recent approach I've had is from AOL Europe. And what they're doing is they're now, because they have to compete to sell their advertising, they have to get people going to their website.
Right.
And therefore they have to have original content. They have
news.
To drive
people to the website, right?
Exactly. Well, they've got news and stuff, but everyone else has got news. So they need something different. And people are very interested in finding out stuff about themselves, you know, particularly women. Women's magazines are full of these questionnaires.
Oh, it's huge,
you know,
sure.
How glamorous are you, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you fill in these questionnaires and you get ratings. Well, these tests would enable people to find out how intuitive they are or how telepathic they are. So AOL are very interested in that, and we haven't come to a definite plan yet, but I'm in discussion with people from AOL about this. So I don't know when it'll happen, sooner or later. I think something like this is bound to happen. And that would then move this whole subject into a different dimension, you see. Instead of parapsychology being a subject which gets tiny amounts of money, which is sort of hounded in the academic world by militant skeptic organizations and treated as totally marginal, even though most people have these experiences, this could become something much more mainstream, something in which lots of people have personal experience of doing scientific tests. I think it'd be good for science. I think it'd be good for the subject. I think it'd be good for any company that took it up. And I think it would help change the perspective, make people say, well, what's all the fuss about? Yes, of course these things happen. And, you know, accept them as part of our normal human ability and animal ability too.
Rupert, tell me about this phototelepathy test. This is an interesting one.
Yes, the phototelepathy test that's a test where the question there is, can you tell when I'm looking at your photo? Because when I look
from afar.
From afar, yes. So you, for example, George, if you were the subject for this test,
okay.
when you do the test, you sign on and you upload a picture of yourself. Then, in a series of tests, either I see a picture of you or I see a picture of somebody else. And say test one, trial one comes up, I see a picture of you or someone else.
Well, are you looking at the picture of me?
Yes,
or
okay. It comes on my computer screen.
Okay.
It's an online test. So it's on. I'm online, you're online. We're both logged on to the same site, on my website. A picture of you comes up on my screen, and so when I see you, I think about you. Hard to avoid, you know, from looking at your picture. You then are told that test trial one is happening now, and at the end of trial one, which is only 10 seconds long, you have to guess, was Rupert looking at my picture? Yes, no. You have to click, you see. And then after a short break, the next trial happens. It's very quick. So it's to see if you can tell when people are looking at your picture or not. This is an attempt to repeat on the internet an experiment I've already done without the internet. How we did the real experiment is with the real photos and real people is you have someone in one room who either looks at someone's photo or they look at a magazine and read the magazine. And in a series of trials, a person in another room has to guess if their photo is being looked at or not. In those tests, people score above chance. They can tell when someone's looking at their photo if they know each other well. For example, if they're members of the family, they're
great test.
If they're strangers, it doesn't work. And telepathy typically happens between people who know each other well. So I think this test is very interesting because looking at the photo, you see, is something that a lot of people do this. So lots of people carry around pictures of their nearest and dearest in their wallets or, pocketbooks or whatever. And they look at them. People have photos of their relatives in their house, you know, on tables and things in the sitting room. We all use photos as a way of tuning into people we know and thinking about them. And what this suggests is that just looking at their picture, tuning you into them, may actually cause a link with them that some people can actually feel. And even if they can't feel it, it may have an unconscious effect.
What do you think of all these? I assume you're pretty spiritual, aren't you?
I would say so, yes.
Yeah. What do you think of all these books out that are atheist books that seem to be
a lot popular of them recently, isn't there? There's a whole atheist book boom. Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris.
Dawkins' book is The God Delusion?
The God Delusion,
yeah.
That's right. Dan Dennett's book is Breaking the Spell. I reviewed that book, in fact, for the Toronto Globe and Mail, Dennett's book. I think it's interesting. What's interesting is the fact that so many atheists have come out with this anti-religious campaign at the moment. It's not just expressing their own opinion, which is fair enough, but it's a kind of crusade. I think that's what's so interesting about it. It's these, especially Dawkins, he's a fanatic. He's a completely fanatical crusader. He's like a kind of evangelist for atheism. He wants to convert everyone to atheism. He wants to, his aim, as he says, is to eradicate religion from the world. Nothing less than the total eradication of religion. Well, you know, this is sort of fanatical and dangerous stuff, in my opinion. I mean, the last person who tried to eradicate religion was Stalin. You know, the Soviets were atheists, and they tried to eradicate religion.
And look what he did.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, he sent priests to Siberia. He smashed up churches and stuff. Mao Zedong's Red Guards, you know, destroyed temples, persecuted religious believers, and so forth. That kind of militant, fanatical, intolerant atheism is a very, very dangerous force, and it's done a huge amount of harm in the world. So, you know, these atheists point to damage done by religion. It certainly has done a lot of damage. But, you know, arguably, atheism's done a lot more. So what I find disturbing is their kind of fanatical conviction that they're right, you know, that they really are kind of fundamentalists. So the question I ask myself is, you know, why are they so angry? Why are they so upset? Well, in the case of Dawkins and Dennett, I think the reason they're so angry and upset is because of what they see are the resurgence of religion. They always thought religion would die away, or die out, and actually it hasn't. And it's more malignant forms, you know, like
it's fragmented.
Extreme fundamentalism is, in fact, rather scary. And so you can see why people would be upset by that. But to try and attack all religion and all spirituality is throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's like saying science is bad because the Soviets believed in it, and they certainly did. Their whole state was supposed to be based on science.
Well, don't they believe that there's some kind of intelligent design behind everything?
No, not people like Dawkins. No, they think it's just blind chance and natural selection. So they think that their basic worldview, they have a belief system, and it's, you know, it's not that they don't believe in God so much as the fact they do believe in something else. What they believe is that the whole universe is nothing but blind, inanimate matter. It came into being by chance. Everything that's happened is just a matter of chance or laws of nature that have no thought or design behind them. They just happen to be there at the moment of the Big Bang. That the only kind of mind that's emerged in the universe is human intelligence, possibly little green men or other forms of intelligence on other planets, but basically it's biologically based in human beings. There's no bigger mind in the whole universe, like God or anything. It's just human minds. And if human beings think of God, then this is just an idea inside human brains. It's not out there. It's just an illusion in the human brain, generated inside human brains for a variety of reasons, not very creditable reasons. That's their worldview, and you can see why some people might find that plausible, but it's definitely a worldview, an act of faith, because you can't prove that there's no intelligence out there in the universe beyond the human mind. You can't prove that, you can just assume it. So it's really a belief system, and I think a rather narrow and limited one, and it's fine for people to believe it. What worries me is when they try to convert everybody else to their point of view. They think all children should be given this kind of education and so on.
Why do you think all of this is, you know, like your work in the work of telepathy? Why is it so vital?
I think it's very important for us to discover that our minds are much more than just, you know, our bodies and changes inside our brains. Of course, they involve changes in the brain, but I think we have to recognize we're interconnected, and I think that this,
yes, we are,
the sense of interconnection is very important for any healthy form of human life. These things have implications beyond the merely scientific. I think it also enables us to recognize our own experience, to say, yes, these things have happened to me, they do happen, they're part of nature, rather than having to deny whole chunks of our experience in the name of some kind of ideology.
All right, stay with us, Rupert. We've got one more hour to go. What a very fast night. And we're going to open up the phone lines, questions for Rupert Sheldrake, or if you want to share your stories of telepathy with us, that'll be great. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.